Hi, everybody. We'll be starting in a few minutes. Just give me a second here while I get everything lined up. It's always a little tricky in the hotel. Not quite as easy as it is at home. And I will be deleting all this crap afterwards. It looks like YouTube is working. Nobody's there, I guess, but it is working. Right. That looks better. All right. Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Yaron Book Show. Thanks for joining me. I am again in a hotel room. You can see the lighting. The background is all very much hotel lighting, hotel background. And I'm in Zurich today. I just got here this afternoon. Took the train from Geneva. I'd flown into Geneva on Tuesday night, late at night. Spent Wednesday. Yesterday was Wednesday. Yes, it was Wednesday. In meetings all day. And then got together with some local friends here in Sweden. Actually, Luca is listening on YouTube and watching on YouTube, and he organized a little get together at a restaurant in Geneva, which was a blast, a lot of fun. We got to talk, drink a little bit of wine, eat some good food, and had a good time. There's a photo of the five of us up on Facebook. Took the train. The train is gorgeous. I mean, Switzerland's such a beautiful place, and I have to say, the weather is fantastic. The weather in Switzerland has been fantastic. The sun is shining. It's warm. It's great to walk around, and it really is. It really is a pleasure and fun to be here. Today, did some after a morning meeting in Geneva. An afternoon meeting here in Zurich tomorrow. I think I've got one, two, three, four, five meetings in Zurich, and then I'm flying to Barcelona for just to relax, to do nothing. And I'll get there late at night Friday. Saturday, I'm going to meet Barcelona, meet up with a friend, go to a very nice restaurant. Sunday, I'm flying to Canary Islands for the Mont Pelerin Society meeting. The annual meeting there. I'll be seeing Dr. Tara Smith and Dr. Rajshree Agrawal at the Mont Pelerin. So it's going to be a great conference, and the Ayn Rand Institute is going to do a panel there for a breakfast panel with me and Tara and Rajshree. So that should be a lot of fun. All right, so I've got a little bit of time today. I don't have a lot of time. I've got kind of a meeting in about an hour. It'll be 11 o'clock here, but I've got a meeting by phone. I'm not going out. And I thought I'd take the opportunity to talk to you guys. Two main things I want to talk about. One is the Kavanaugh hearing, which I'm actually kind of watching in the background right now. I watched earlier sitting in my hotel room, put on television, and there it is. And I really didn't want to see it. I really didn't want to watch it, but then I said, I'm going to do a show later. I should probably watch it, so I did. So I watched Ford's Dr. Ford's testimony. I'm watching Kavanaugh's testimony right now, or at least I watched the beginning of it. He's still going, so I haven't heard the same thing, the whole thing. But I've heard enough. I've heard enough to reinforce what I said the other day. God, this is a zoo. It's a zoo. This is why you have a court of law. In a court of law, you bring witnesses, you have a jury, you have a trial, you have cross-examination. You have a system of justice to determine whether somebody's guilty or innocent. You don't lob accusations and then defend those accusations. And he said, she said, and even if they bring a few witnesses in front of Congress, that's a completely partisan body. You're never going to get to the truth. I watched Dr. Ford earlier today. She seemed incredibly credible. She clearly was sexually assaulted, or at least I think so. You know, she's a great actress if she's not, and there's no reason to assume she's an actress. But I don't know if the details that she presented were true or not true. You'd have to corroborate them. You'd have to do what police and the judiciary system and the justice system does. And to make this part of a Supreme Court hearing, to make this a circus, a zoo, which is what's going on right now, to make this the standard for whether somebody is nominated to the Supreme Court or not, is worse than pathetic. Worse than pathetic. I mean, I have, I have a lot of qualms, or some qualms, with Kavanaugh's judicial philosophy, with his, I fear, what he's actually going to, what he's going to rule on and overturn certain things, and other things he's probably pretty good. But, you know, his opening statement, the statement he's made was excellent. He basically said, this is a zoo. You know, you have no real evidence. You've got one witness. What are you going to do? He was angry. Man, was he angry. I don't know. If you haven't watched Kavanaugh's response, you got to watch it, at least the first 20 minutes. Man, he's angry. He's going after them. He's going after, again, in a very partisan way. He's going after the left. He's going after Democrats. He's all fire and brimstone. And, you know, whether that works as a political tactic or not, I don't know. I don't care. I mean, the whole politics of this is disgusting to me. I mean, here is an important nomination to the most important court in the land, a court that might have more to say about the future of liberty in America than anything else, because our politicians certainly are not concerned with liberty, and our politicians don't seem to be doing anything about liberty or about debating liberty. And here's somebody who's actually going to do something one way or the other, pro or anti-liberty, however you want to perceive it. And this is what's going to determine whether he goes on the Supreme Court or not, something he did or didn't do 36 years ago. And I'm open to both theories, that he did or didn't do them. Although, again, Kavanaugh seemed sincere. He's cried at least 3 or 4 times during his testimony. He has been unequivocal in his statement about the fact that he did not commit this. She was credible, too. And when she was asked, are you sure that it was Kavanaugh who assaulted you? She said, absolutely, I am sure that it is him, 100% confident. Right? Again, this is why you have a court system. This is why you prosecute people. But this is also why you have a statute of limitations. Because you can't, it's almost impossible to investigate a crime 32 years ago. Now, as I've said before, if there was a pattern, if somebody came and said, up and said, I clerked for him and he did this or that to me. But this is just pathetic. Pathetic. What's even more pathetic, I guess, is that everybody's watching it, right? Everybody's watching this. That this is what American people really care about. That this is what American people are really engaged in. This is what they're concerned about in terms of the nomination to the Supreme Court. When he testified 2 weeks ago, about his legal philosophy, when he was questioned about it to the extent that he revealed anything, nobody listened, nobody cared. You know, on the left, he was the devil. On the right, he was, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. He could do no wrong. Nobody actually analyzed his judicial philosophy. Nobody actually discussed how he would rule on key points. Now that there's sex involved, there he is. He's crying again. I've got the television right in front of me open, and he's crying again. I mean, the guy, that's number 5, I think. And I can understand it. Imagine any of you, somebody out of the blue comes out and says, you know, you sexually abused me once, and does it on a public stage, the whole country to see on television. Everybody sees it, your family, everybody. That is pretty traumatic. That is pretty traumatic. Anyway, as I said, this is the kind of stuff that should be dealt with in a court of law. This is not the kind of stuff that should be the central focus of a nomination for the Supreme Court of the United States. And I emphasize that a 36-year allegation should be dismissed, in my view, unless there's a pattern that continued into his 20s and 30s, into his 30s, certainly. This should have been dismissed a long time ago. It should never have been brought up. So he was a, even if the worst case scenario, everything she said is true, he was a scumbag in high school. Does that disqualify him from Supreme Court? I don't think so. If he's a scumbag today, then sure. But then you'd need to prove that. As he says, he's been vetted by the FBI six times. He's been at the highest levels of our government for 30 years, 20 plus years. He was on Air Force One with George W. Bush over and over and over again. At no point did anybody accuse him of anything. He was confirmed by the Senate for a a few years ago. Nobody came forward then. So again, while there's no question, if you watch Dr. Ford's testimony, she looks credible. Looks credible. That's my point, right? She has no evidence. She certainly has no proof. There's nothing that can be done with what she's saying. There's nothing that can be done with what she's saying. If there's evidence of anything happening that in terms of this, in terms of sexual harassment in a few short interruptions here and there on the audio. Yeah, I don't think it's my microphone. It might not be a great connection if you're seeing that's not good if you're losing sound once in a while. Facebook, are you losing sound once in a while as well? Or is it just on YouTube? I suspect it's the internet connection. These hotels, even though this is a wide connection, it's not a fast connection. But I will try to speak more clearly. It's not Wi-Fi. I actually have a wired connection here. So, we will see. We will see. Anyway, I consider this a travesty. I mean, the founders must be rolling in their grave. The idea that this is what the Senate, this is what our political class, this is what concerns them, and this is what concerns the American people. This is what they care about. Now, I am the first to defend the whole idea of Me Too. I think men's attitude towards women have been over the decades despicable. I think there's much more sexual harassment that should be that much more sexual harassment than is reported, and none of it should be tolerated. Sexual harassment should never be tolerated. But this is absurd. This is absurd. You need again, you need evidence. You need a court of law. All right. Kavanaugh's still speaking, and my guess is he's based on the first 20 minutes. I'm sure his testimony is going to be quite impressive. He looks like an impressive guy, just based on this. So, I don't know how this is going to end because I don't play the politics. I think he might impress Republicans enough so that Republicans will rally around him. We will see. We will see. But it's hard to tell. And again, I'm not for him. Particularly, I worry about this nomination to the Supreme Court. I don't think that's the point. I think the point is that this is what politics is today. It's about defaming. It's about sexual accusations from 30 years, 6 years ago. It's about playing dirty politics. It's about getting anything you can on the other side. And both parties do this. Both parties do this. It's about not talking about ideas. It's about avoiding talking about ideas as much as possible and talking about the non-essentials. But again, we get the politicians we deserve. We get the emphasis from the media we deserve. And that's what we're seeing. All right, I got a couple of Super Chat questions here, unrelated, or at least these are. Let's see if there's one related. The arbitrary has no cognitive standing. These were arbitrary accusations. Republican lost the second they treated them as serious. I don't see it that way. If a woman stands up and says somebody sexually accused it, that's not necessarily arbitrary. You have to investigate to determine that. And I think given the world in which we live, given the fact of sexual harassment, this is not unthinkable. This is not gremlins under the desk. This is not a being in the sky who whispers in people's ears. This is not the arbitrary in that point. This is somebody expressing it. She has evidence that she has expressed these ideas about Kavanaugh before. That is, she expressed it to a psychologist. In couples training, she had told friends. So it isn't something that she just made up at the spur of the moment. I mean, think about what the arbitrary really means. The arbitrary means no evidence, no proof, something completely detached from reality. This is not detached from reality. A teenage boy is getting drunk. It's not crazy. Nothing she said is crazy. You could see, you know, I could see Kavanaugh doing it. It wouldn't shock me at all. This happened in high school. This is not, I'm not saying boys should be boys, as some people said, but this happened in high school a lot. And it happens in high schools a lot. So it's not some random, crazy, arbitrary statement. Now, if she claims this, the burden of proof is on her. He is guilty. He is innocent until proven guilty. And that's why you have an investigation. That's why you have a court of law. That's why you do these things. But that's also, as I've stated, why you have a statute of limitation because of the impossibility or certainly the difficulty in proving such cases over such a long time. She is a witness. She experienced it. Now, you can say she's not a strong witness. She can say she's a biased witness. But if I tell you, I was walking today to a restaurant and I stumbled in the street. Is that arbitrary? Me telling you something? Now, you weren't there. Nobody else saw me stumble in the street. I can't prove that I stumbled in the street. I'm saying I stumbled in the street. Does that make it arbitrary? I mean, I might be lying to you. That's certainly true. But you have no basis to assume that. And in any case, it's not arbitrary. It might be wrong. It might be false. It might be a lie. So don't confuse these issues epistemologically, and don't treat them the same. You don't, if somebody walks into a police station and says, Joe raped me, nobody saw it, but he raped me. Or he just assaulted me, rape, I guess there's evidence, you know, you can physical, biological evidence, but he assaulted me. Do you just say, well, it's just you, you know, it's just an arbitrary statement? No, that's ridiculous. So epistemologically, be careful in how you consider these thoughts. And again, this is the thing that scares me about this whole phenomena, is the level at which this is all about partisanship. So this is a leftist conspiracy to defame Kavanaugh. Maybe it is, but again, it's arbitrary unless you provide proof that it is. And on the right, Kavanaugh can do no wrong. So that's on the right. Kavanaugh can do no wrong. It's a leftist conspiracy. And on the left is, well, if she said it, it must be true. All men are pigs, and because they want Kavanaugh gone. And as Kavanaugh said in the beginning of his testimony, I mean, he's being called names by Democrats on this committee. He's being called evil. I mean, this is part of what's happened to the process of appointing judges. Instead of actually reviewing the history, instead of reviewing the philosophy, instead of evaluating based on their judiciary philosophy and thinking about it and based on their qualifications. Today, it's all about, are they on the right or are they on the left? Are they Republican enough or are they Democratic enough? And gone are the days where people were evaluated based on their qualifications. President gets to nominate the Supreme Court judges. You're not going to get the kind of Supreme Court judges you want if the other party has won. But many times you've got a president of one party and a Senate of the other party. What are you never going to confirm a nominee because they're never going to be as left or as right as you want them to be? I mean, that's completely dysfunctional and completely non-objective. They have to be objective standards for deciding your judges. Now, I believe the objective standard should be, is he going to defend individual rights? And by that standard, none of the judges on the Supreme Court would be there. But at least if the Democrats and the Republicans had some standards and they were discussing those standards and debating those standards, that would be nice. All right. Linuxgate. Is the Fountainhead becoming reality? I have no idea what Linuxgate is. So sorry, George, you put $5 into this question. But somebody's going to have to send me a link to an article and tell me about what this is, because I don't know what it is. Does somebody blow up a Linux thing? I don't know. Just let me know. Okay, Adam asks, what do you think about banned topics and people for criticizing you? For example, why be show Facebook pages criticism disrespectful and wrong? No, I mean, criticism is not necessarily disrespectful and wrong, but the YB... Facebook group has a particular purpose, and that's to discuss the show and to discuss the topic that I discuss in the show, and to do so in a way that is respectful of me. It's the Yaron Brook Show Facebook page created by Yaron Brook Show fans. Not by Yaron. You can go and create a Yaron Brook Show enemies page, and you can do whatever you want. Criticism is fine, but disrespect is not. Criticism is fine, but virulent name calling and hatred is not. Distorting my positions and repeating it over and over and over again is not fine, right? It's not fine. So criticize all you want. I'm happy to be criticized. If it's respectful, if it's connected to reality, if it's based on something I actually said or based on an opinion I actually hold. But if you are strawmanning me, if you're making up positions that I don't really have, if you're listening to half the sentences but not the other sentences, and then if you call me names, if you're going to argue that I'm not an objectivist, then I don't want you on my fan. I don't want you on my page. I don't want you on my fan page. Not on that page. You can go to your Yaron Brook page, which is more broad and more general. I have 41,000 followers, likes there. You know. Nobody is policing that page. But in the Yaron Brook Show page, which is run by fans, it's being policed. And if it's being policed, it's being policed in a way to extract people who are disrespectful, rude, and, you know, nasty and lying about me. So I don't see any problem with that. I did not, for the record, did not ask that any topics be banned. I did not ask that anybody be taken off the page, but I'm thankful for those who did it. You know, to have a question that says, "What's Yaron wrong about?" I mean, really, what kind of a question is that? I mean, it's just silly, right? You could say, "What kind of topics do you disagree with Yaron about? What do you, you know, what would you wish he covered and he's not covering?" You know, that's fine, but. You know, just to have an excuse to complain is I think inappropriate on a page like that. Other pages, go do it. Go have fun. Criticizing me, calling me names, declaring I have certain positions I don't have. Go for it. Just don't do it on a page that is dedicated to my show. That's all. And look, I value respect. One of the problems with a certain class of my critics is that they don't know what the word means. They have no respect. They have no respect for me. They have no respect for reality. They have no respect for the facts, but they certainly have no respect for me. And I'm not going to engage with you if you show, if you from the beginning show disrespect and not really in it for a discussion or debate, but in it to prove that Yaron is wrong. Well, then what do you need me for? Go prove it. What do you need my sites for? What do you need my platform for? Go do it on your platform, right? Here's a question. Neoliberalism is a pejorative nowadays. Comment. Yeah, it is a pejorative, which is really sad. Neoliberalism is a term given to the relatively pro-capitalist, relatively, I say, because they're not true free markets, but relatively pro-free market policies of the post-Thatcher Reagan years, primarily with regard to free trade, primarily with regard to the opening and loosening up of regulations and restrictions in the economies of the third world or in the developing world, in China, in Asia, even in Africa, in countries all over the world, Eastern Europe. Neoliberalism was the idea that liberalism was a good thing. Liberalism being liberty, coming from liberty, not the liberalism of the left in the United States, the association, but the liberalism of the 19th century, the liberalism that still is associated with freedom in Europe. The neoliberalism was the idea that it's a revival of liberalism, a revival of the idea of freedom, the revival of the idea of free markets, that those were good things and those should be pursued by countries all across the world. The left tagged neoliberalism as an evil idea, particularly after the financial crisis, which it blamed on capitalism, free markets, neoliberalism. And the left has been aggressively pursuing a strategy that's anti-liberal, anti-neoliberal in this case. Now, I think the more recent development is, the more interesting development is that the right has joined in, that today neoliberalism is a word hated by the right as well. It's just put globalism instead of neoliberalism. The idea of a free trade, the idea that the success of other countries is beneficial to our own success, the idea of win-win relationships between economies, the idea of win-win relationship as trade relationships, all of that is smeared now by the right, and in that sense, they are smearing neoliberalism as well. So I think that both on the left and on the right, as often is the case, there is a uniform dismissal of what is called neoliberalism, a uniform dismissal of free markets, a uniform dismissal of free trade, a uniform dismissal of of the beauty and the just how wonderful it is to see developing countries become richer, be successful. I love traveling around the world because I get to see the success, I get to see the prosperity, I get to see how wonderful life is out there. And that people have succeeded and people had advanced and all of that, as I said, is a good thing, not a bad thing. So I'm not a neoliberal because I think they're too, statist for my liking. I am more of a free marketer than the neoliberals are, and I'm for even greater free trade than the neoliberals are. As I said, the only trade strategy that makes moral and economic sense is unilaterally lowering tariffs to zero and not caring what other people do. That's true of America. That's true of China. If China was smart, they would tell Donald Trump to go, whatever, and they would lower tariffs to zero right now. And the Chinese economy would improve significantly, and the U.S. economy would suffer. And if you think Donald Trump would follow the Chinese by lowering his tariffs, you don't understand Donald Trump. Okay, let's see. Are you guys still having problems seeing or listening? Let me know. Let us see. Yes, I did want to talk about this topic. It's an important topic. So I caught this today and I thought that this would be very appropriate. And some of you are going to be ticked off at me, but you know what? Reality and facts are what they are. Oh my God, I'm watching the video. I can't even hear what he's saying, but just the expression of Kavanaugh's face is priceless. He's going after Feinstein. I mean, he's half crying, half yelling. I mean, he is angry. When? I mean, I wish, let me just say this. I wish that the CEOs of high-tech companies and the CEOs of businesses and the CEOs of banks was angry at Congress as Kavanaugh is right now. Oh, that would make my day. That would be so cool. That would be absolutely so cool. Anyway, thank you for the super chat questions. You can keep them coming. Anyway, I noticed this today, and I thought this was a perfect to talk about. I think you'll be interested in it. The new rankings for economic freedom are out. So, you know, there are a couple of different rankings that are published. This is the Economic Freedom of the World Index. There's another Economic Freedom Index put out by Heritage. This is one put out by the Fraser Institute in Canada, and together with the Cato Institute in the United States. There's also one put out by Heritage. There's also a freedom index that combines economic freedom with social freedoms, which is interesting. Anyway, the amazing news, well, it's not as amazing as one would think, but the good news is that the United States has climbed up to number 6 in the rankings. Now, I don't remember which rankings it was, but one of the rankings, the United States had dropped to number 18. So the fact that it has climbed up to number 8 is fantastic news. So there were only number 6. There were only 5 countries ahead of the United States. I'm sitting in one of them. Switzerland is at number 4. Number 1 is Hong Kong. Number 2 is Singapore. Number 3 is New Zealand. Number 4 is Switzerland. Number 5 is Ireland. Ireland, I've been praising Ireland on many shows. Ireland's doing very well. I'll add the number 7. I'll talk about this in a minute, is Georgia. Georgia, where I'm going to go in November, which is a country I'm very excited about and very positive about. So anyway, United States is number 6. And I was thinking, oh, wow, this is great. And immediately I thought to myself, everybody going to say this is the Trump effect. This is a consequence of Trump. But you see, I know that when they publish these results, they publish them 2 years after the fact. So the United States is number 6 as of 2016, as of before Trump becomes president. The United States is number 6 under that evil, horrible, unmentionable President Obama. Now, I'm no fan of Obama's, but I'll just note that, the United States not only rose to number 6, but rose in terms of the value. They give a number to every country. And during this period, the United States rose from the bottom. And the bottom was under, the bottom was under Obama as well in 2011. We were kind of strongly under 8. But by 2016... Because of the fact, in my view, that we had divided government, that is, that Republicans were elected to Congress, and basically clamped down on Obama's ability to do anything too damaging, and actually forced Obama to, on a relative basis, reduce spending. As a consequence of that, the rating of the United States has gone up to number 6. So this, I would give credit to this, to the Republican Congress, the Republican House and Senate, but really to divided government. I think the credit goes here to divided government. The worst is when the Democrats control everything. The second worst is when Republicans control everything. The best is when you have a Democratic president and the Republican House and Senate. That's what the numbers show. That's what the numbers show. In terms of economic liberty, the best combination is a Democratic president with a House and Senate controlled by a Republican. So, and the numbers bear this out. So if you look at this index over time, you know when it was best? When the United States, at least in recent memory, since the 1970s, when it had the highest Economic Freedom Index rating, not ranking. It used to be number 3. It was number 3, but also the highest rating in terms of number. It almost had a 9. Anybody know when that was? Well, that was actually at the end of the Clinton years, because the United States, for a little bit, they had a balanced budget. Clinton hadn't done anything awful in terms of regulation, indeed with welfare reform and with deregulation of Sarbanes-Oxley Glass-Steagall, and a few other things, had actually deregulated. So from the Jimmy Carter days through what's his name, Reagan, it then flattens out a little bit. It flattens out under Bush Senior. Bush was terrible. And then it goes up again under Clinton. And then it just goes down precipitously, primarily because government spending goes out of control. But then you've got Sarbanes-Oxley under George Bush. You've got increased regulations under George Bush. It was just a disaster. And first term of Obama's was terrible from an economic freedom index perspective. Second term was excellent. Somebody says here Carter was terrible. He wasn't. From an economic freedom index perspective, Jimmy Carter was one of the better presidents we've had. More deregulation happened, more deregulation at the legislative level, which is where it counts, where it's most important. More deregulation happened at the legislative level under Jimmy Carter than did under Ronald Reagan. I mean, massive deregulation of trucking, of airlines, of financial services. And you could go on and on and on, all happened under Jimmy Carter, for a variety of historical reasons. I've talked about this before. So, good news. What will Trump's rankings look like? What will the economy look under Trump? Well, my suspicion is that, so you'll have two factors that will increase our rating. The factors are going to be deregulation at the agency level, which will increase the rankings a little, which will increase the rating a little bit. And then you have the tax cuts, which will definitely increase the rating a little bit. On the flip side, tariffs will decrease the rating quite a bit. And spending out of control. Spending, this is Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican president, just like the Bush years, spending out of control will decrease the rating. Net, we'll see. We'll see next year and the year after that, ratings as they come out. We'll see if the score of the United States improves under Trump or gets worse under Trump. Objective, as objective as you can get with these kind of ratings, measure as you can, the second term of Obama turns out to be not so bad in comparison to other things. Oh, somebody's asking what's Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley was a horrible, the largest bill to regulate business passed by Congress since the Great Depression. And that was under Bush. The conservative Republicans, the Senate, which was Republican at the time, voted on it 98-0. 98-0. Largest regulatory bill since the Great Depression. Republicans love that kind of stuff. Love that kind of stuff. So don't worship Republicans. Please don't worship Republicans. It's interesting. Let me just see. Number five before the last year, just to number 19 after Obama left to number 20. Yeah, I haven't seen the Heritage and Wall Street Journal index lately. And again, you can't really do, I don't think anybody can really have an index for Trump yet because you don't have the data, not the detailed data. So if the Heritage have already published the first year of Trump, then I think they're probably wrong. I know the people who do, or some of the people who do the Cato slash Fraser Institute, and they're good. They're good free market Austrian economists, so I think it's good. Jennifer asks in a super chat question, why do Republicans in Congress act differently towards Democratic presidents? Because they're a great opposition party. It's very easy to be negative. It's very easy to be against stuff. It's very easy to go against stuff. It's very hard to stand up and defend your position. And Republicans can't do it. They don't have the moral backbone. They don't have the belief. Plus, they're corrupt. So they want their own districts funded. They want their own projects funded. They don't have a philosophy. So when they defend against a Democrat, it's not out of conviction. It is out of partisanship. So because we don't have a government of ideas, we don't have political parties of ideas, It boils down to the politics of it. It's in the politics of it that gridlock is the best outcome. And Republicans are very good. Do you remember the budgets that Paul Ryan passed when they, under Obama years in the House of Representatives? One budget actually turned Medicare into a voucher system. It cut real it I think it actually cut spending. It certainly reduced the growth rate and reduced the percentage of spending as part of GDP dramatically. So, I mean, that was a good budget. I would supported that budget, or at least supported elements of the budget. I would have liked to see it much more aggressive. Do you remember when Rand Paul proposed a budget under the Obama years that actually cut half $1 trillion from government spending in the first year? Half $1 trillion. And what happened? What happened? Right. What happened when the Republicans gained a majority in the Senate and get the presidency? Has Rand proposed that budget now under Trump? No. No. I think he was the only Republican who didn't vote for the Trump budget, the budget that Congress actually passed. But did he propose the $500 billion cut? No. No. He did it while the Democrats were in power. He did it partially because he knew it would lose. The same with Paul Ryan. They're very good at proposing ideas they know will lose. It's the same with repealing Obamacare. When they knew that Obama wouldn't let the repeal of Obamacare go, when they knew he would veto it, they passed it. As soon as they got a Republican in the in the White House who would sign off of it, they didn't want to own it. In other words, they're cowards, they're non-ideological, they're pragmatists, they're nothings. They're nothings. Mildly on some issues better than Democrats, but only on some issues. Let me just answer this one before I get to the Vietnam War. If Obama was a statist, how did the U.S. become more free? I explained that. Obama was a statist, but because Congress was held by Republicans and because Republicans are relatively pro-free markets, Republicans basically prevented Obama from doing anything bad. And as part, if you remember, there was a deal cut at some point between Obama and the Republicans by which government spending was actually capped, a deal that was thrown out by the Trump administration so that government spending now is growing out of control. But under the Obama years, the last four Obama years, post-stimulus, government spending did not grow as a percentage of GDP. It actually shrunk as a percentage of GDP, shrunk quite significantly because Republicans were very cautious in how they spent money. So, again, gridlock is our friend. A Democratic president, even a statist Democratic president with a Republican House and Senate, often is the best deal because then you don't get Republicans trying to chew away at abortion. You don't get Republicans trying to chew away at other rights. They violate our rights on things that they agree with, for example, on listening to our conversations and monitoring our cell phones and ignoring our privacy completely. The NSA, both the left and the right agree on, so we got that under Obama, and the Republicans didn't stop that. We got on that under Bush, sorry, and then Obama only reinforced that. But when it comes to economic issues, the Republicans kind of stalemate the Democrats, and when it comes to social issues, the Democrats stalemate the Republicans. It's as good as we can do right now. I don't think we can do any better than that. And I think that, the Trump presidency with spending out of control is evidence of the fact that voting Republican into all parts of government is a disaster. Sequestration, it's called. That's right. That's what it was. It was sequestration. The deal was that, in order to get a budget passed, they were gonna cut spending, or they were gonna shrink spending by a certain amount every year, at least in terms of the percent of GDP. All right. Was there a way for the U.S. to win the Vietnam War? In the Ken Burns documentary, it seems like there was no way to crush the will of the Viet Cong. Yes, of course, there was a way for the U.S. to win the Vietnam War, but to win the Vietnam War, you had to want to win the Vietnam War. I am convinced that the U.S. never wanted to win the Vietnam War. Certainly, never wanted to do what was necessary in order to win the Vietnam War. Now, let me be clear. Ayn Rand was against the Vietnam War. I am certainly against the Vietnam War. I think it was a stupid war. I think it was a wasted war. I think the United States should have let Southern Vietnam fall in the 1960s instead of dragging it out and letting it fall in the 1970s. The way to win the Vietnam War is basically to invade the North and to crush the North Vietnamese army and to crush the communist regime in the North. You cannot win a guerrilla war against committed guerrillas. You have to, and this is why you can't win a war on terrorism. I've said this since 9/11. You cannot beat Al-Qaeda and ISIS unless you go to the source, unless you go to Iran and Saudi Arabia. You couldn't win in South Vietnam unless you went to the source, which is North Vietnam. We needed to crush North Vietnam if we were going to win the war. But there was no political will to do that. There was no political will to really engage in a ground war, to actually invade the North and go after them and destroy the Communist Party that ruled it. There was no political will to prove to the Viet Cong that they were fighting in a losing cause that could go nowhere. And the consequence was a stalemate that the United States, well, not a stalemate, the United States lost the war and tens of thousands of American kids died for nothing. Now, I don't think winning the war would have been a good thing, but if you're going to be there, and this is what Ayn Rand said, win it. If you're going to go to war, win it. No, China did not. Wait. Didn't China send their own troops? So therefore, no. And I don't know why I'm taking your questions when you're not paying up. But China did not send troops. China is hostile to Vietnam. Vietnam was much more affiliated with the Russians than they were with the Chinese. China and Vietnam have fought wars against each other. And no, that was Korea, by the way. China sent troops into Korea, another war we didn't win. Another war that, because we didn't win, we're still paying a heavy price for. Another war in which tens of thousands of American kids died for nothing. Another war we should have never been in. And we wouldn't have, that is a bit of a history lesson and unrelated. All right, so let me just do this. I think the Economic Freedom Index are interesting. I would just say Georgia being number 7 is pretty amazing. Mauritius is number 8. United Kingdom number 9. Australia number 10. If we keep going down, we've got Taiwan, not surprising. Estonia, Lithuania, 13, tied for 13. Chile in number 15. Chile's got a relatively free economy. Denmark, the so-called socialist economy, is in number 16. It's interesting. In the other ratings, Sweden is much higher. I need to sit down. I'll sit down and compare the two ratings and give you my assessment of why there's such a gap between the ratings. But, Cyprus is pretty good. Netherlands is pretty good in the top 20. Germany is number 20. Denmark is more economically free than Germany. Nobody accuses Germany of being socialist. How do you get to accuse Denmark of being socialist? Romania, number 20. Now I'm starting to be skeptical. I don't think Romania belongs in the top 20. But again, this is data driven. Let's see, Luxembourg, Norway, 25. Interesting, the top African country, let's see. Israel is number 38. Rwanda, top African country, is number 40. Japan is number 41. And Jordan is number 42. So those of you who love Japan, who think Japan is the be-all, end-all, 41 in economic freedom. There's a reason why the economy has stagnated for 30 years. Just one point above Jordan. And then Rwanda, it's pretty impressive. Rwanda being a number 40, major reforms in Rwanda, moving in the right direction. Good for them. I hope they rise even further and faster in the rankings. They've done some really courageous and important reforms. I'm excited about Rwanda. Israel is 38. Of course, I'd like them to be a lot higher than that. All right. Good. Guatemala, I think, is the highest in Latin/Central America at 23. I don't think it's an accident. It has the it has a university that is that teaches free market economics better than probably any other country in the world. So Mauritius is in Africa, of course. Wow, how did I screw that up? Mauritius is in Africa. Then number eight, Rwanda is second place. But I'm encouraged about Rwanda, given the genocide that occurred there, and given what I've heard about the reforms that are going on there, that things are going to get much better over there. All right, unless there's a quick super chat question, I'm going to wrap things up here. Just under an hour. I'm going to prepare for this meeting I have, and maybe watch a little bit of the Kavanaugh hearing and see what people are saying about it. Enjoy your week. I'll be back sometime during the weekend, probably on Saturday, for another show. I did want to say this. I want to give a plug. I just put up on YouTube a new video. It's an old video. It's a video of me and Daniel Pipes talking about free speech and the threat of Islam and Islamic totalitarianism back in 2006. And I think it's a great video. I think Daniel Pipes is good. I think I was excellent on that night. There's a lot of Muslims in the audience. There's a lot of Muslims that confront us. You can see that. But I found it interesting. I've been doing this since 2006, from before 2006. I've been talking about free speech. It seems like the world has suddenly discovered free speech as an issue. I think through Dave Rubin and others. But I and the Ayn Rand Institute, we've been talking about this issue since the early 2000s, certainly since the 1989, when with the issue of Salman Rushdie and the Ayn Rand Institute putting out a four-page ad in the, I think, in the New York Times. And we were really engaged in this in 2006 with the Danish cartoons. That's how I got to know Fleming Rose, the man who published the Danish cartoons. I got to know Daniel Pipes because we did so many events together. But I highly recommend, I think you will really enjoy. And you'll see a young Yurong Brook. That's not a bad thing, is it? It's 12 years ago. I actually have some brown hair back then and fewer wrinkles, and I look much younger. But you should definitely go back and watch that. And I think one of the things that's unappreciated by the objectivist movement is how on top of these issues the Ayn Rand Institute has been since the late 80s through the 90s through the 2000s. We were calling the issue of the threat of Iran and fundamentalist, Islam and the Islamists, the jihadists. We were on top of the free speech issue, and it's connected to Islam way before any of these other people, way before it became a public issue in the mainstream, and way before everybody else is capitalizing. We were talking about, I just did this thing with Douglas Murray. We were talking about the end of Western civilization, the decay of Western civilization. Ayn Rand was talking about in the 50s, and all her observations back then are still true today. So sometimes I feel like people don't have an historical perspective on the work we have done at the Institute all these decades. And a video like this is a good reminder that on this issue, we've been on top of it, and we've been adamant, and we've been strong, and we've been, maybe most importantly, right about it. So go watch it. I think you'll enjoy it. And I will see you all probably on Saturday. Have a great rest of the week, and have a great weekend.